Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We begin the show today by talking about dreams and the impact they can have on our history and on our culture with our guest, Bridget Vance. She is an associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton, teaches a course on the comparative history of dreams, and her research is on dreams and dream divination in the early modern China. Bridget has lived in China, Taiwan, and Japan, and so has a lot of experience in that part of the world. What are you wondering about how dreams have changed the way we all live? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell you what, maybe we can start by talking about how you happen to stumble on this particular area of research, or maybe it found you. I don't know.
Probably a little of both. I think the topic sort of finds you in a way. I grew up very interested in dreams. My parents often asked me and my younger sister what we dreamed the night before, and you know, over oatmeal or scrambled eggs, we used to talk a lot about our dreams. And I suppose when I was in college, I started studying Mandarin Chinese and psychology, and I remember probably family, relatives, neighbors, what on earth do those two things have in common? And I often wondered that myself. And it was really later, I graduated from college. I was living in China. And one of my work colleagues, you know, I was working at an educational software company. And one of my colleagues said, I heard you're kind of interested in dreams. And I said, yeah. And he said, listen, I have a book that I think you might like to read. And he gave me a republication of a 17th century dream encyclopedia from China.
Wow.
And I was absolutely fascinated. And that's one of the reasons I decided to go back to school to get a master's and then ultimately a PhD. So it was, I would say, in a way, a chance encounter.
A chance encounter. And there's an encyclopedia of dreams. Do we have something like that in our country?
Well, there are actually, interestingly enough, there are copies of the original Dream Encyclopedia that was published, you know, in 1636 in China at the Harvard Yenching Library. So we actually, the United States, we have an original copy. There are so many incredible publications on dreams in every genre and every language imaginable. I think it's something that really fascinates people, not just historically, but also today.
Have you had some memorable dreams in your lifetime?
Oh, goodness, yes. So many. You know, in the course of doing my research, I learned about a practice called a dream incubation practice. And there's a temple in southeastern China that was historically very well known. People used to go there and they would pray for dreams in the hopes of, you know, having life's questions answered for them in the form of a dream. And in the summer of 2015, I was able to travel to this very dream temple and stay there for 3 days and three nights. And it was there that I actually had some very interesting dreams. Perhaps in part, you know, I was staying in a little hostel, and directly behind the hostel was a small farm, and the chickens and roosters and pigs woke me often out of a deep slumber. So I think I was well disposed to remembering those dreams as well.
What do you learn about another time and place by looking at how people approach dreams?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. You know, I think part of what we can learn is what was on people's minds, not just as individuals, but were there any patterns? I think the other aspect that really interests me is what did people in different times and places think dreams meant, and why did we dream, and for what reason do we dream? And these are some of the questions that we can begin to answer when we look into dream records, written ones. That's primarily what I've been working on, but you know, there are many other ways of accessing dreams. I think some people do digital recordings of their dreams now, but historically that was not possible.
Well, Mark and Bloomer wonders if you know anything about vivid reoccurring dreams, and have you heard of that happening in history?
Oh, yes. There are certainly records that, I'll just use an example from this dream encyclopedia that I have studied. It's 36 volumes. It's, 12,000 pages. It's pretty hefty. And within that dream encyclopedia, there are entries in which it's clear that there are individuals who have basically the same dreams, and that there are also folks who have different people who have the same dreams. And so there are questions then about what does that mean if I have the same dream as someone else? I've met a few people who work currently in sort of in a contemporary context with dreams that that come up again and again, and it's almost like you can't really shake them. But I think people have very different approaches and different answers to what that means for them. And I suppose that's maybe one aspect of dream interpretation that I find a little bit perhaps more compelling, is that it really does matter what the individual dreamer thinks about their dreams. You know, the meaning of a dream needs to resonate for the dreamer in order for it to really, for the interpretation to stick, let's say.
Yeah. Well, your research is focused on early modern China. So maybe you can give us some context about that time period in China. And by the way, when was the early modern China?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, you ask a historian about periodization and it can sort of go on for hours. Briefly, though, this is, you know, China had a dynastic history up until the beginning of the 20th century. And, early modern really refers to, I would say, primarily the last two dynasties in China. So I'm looking at the 1600s, primarily late 1500s, 1600s. And at least in China, this is sort of right before a dynastic shift. So from the Ming Dynasty to the Qing Dynasty, it was a time of chaos, many would say, of ambivalence, of unruliness. And you can sort of see that in the political structure, right? Anytime you have the end of an era, the end of a dynasty, things got very complicated. It was also an era marked by climate change. This was the so-called Little Ice Age. So things were, I would say, complicated climactically. It was also a time in which there were many, many people. So the folks who I'm studying were highly educated, read, wrote, worked on a lot of different topics. And they were really, they received their education and their training really primarily with the purpose of working for and in the bureaucracy. That was sort of why people got an education. And it was a moment in Chinese history in which the sort of the emperors at the end of the Ming Dynasty stopped filling bureaucratic positions. There was attention turned away from what was happening in the provinces. And I think for a lot of these educated men, they were quite frustrated that a lot of their career paths had been cut off or curtailed. And some of them turned to dreams. And so we see this proliferation of publications about dreams in literature, poetry, and, you know, these dream encyclopedias, these huge projects of collecting information and publishing them. So that's a little context. I could dig deeper into the weeds, but hopefully that's enough to kind of chew on.
It does. It does give us enough to chew on. I'm wondering what kinds of dreams then they had back then. What would happen in a notable dream, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things that I really was fascinated by, I would say, the most in this dream encyclopedia. You know, by this time, right, I'd studied Mandarin in college. I moved to China after I graduated. I taught for a year. I did an intensive language program. And I could read the characters, you know, and Chinese is written in characters. But there were parts of this dream encyclopedia that really I couldn't understand. I couldn't make sense of. And I love a good puzzle. So I found that absolutely fascinating. And one of the dreams that I couldn't, you know, I could read it and understand the dream, but I couldn't understand why the explanation was the dream of an emperor. And the entry in the encyclopedia simply stated that the emperor dreamed that the Yellow River had dried up. And that was it. And that the dream interpreter, there was a diviner who was present, and the encyclopedia then gives the divination, which said, things are going to be just fine. And you have the context. So the emperor was very worried that the Yellow River drying up would mean the end of his rule. You know, the symbol in China for ruler was a dragon, which was a water-dwelling creature. And he imagined, I think, that the dragon without water would die. Therefore, the Chinese state would crumble and fall apart. And I found this very interesting that the answer that the dream diviner gave was that the emperor would be just fine. The state would not fall. And it was really in digging into that a little bit further and consulting with my host father in Beijing, using these sort of old dictionaries and other reference books, that you can find a little bit more context to the dream. And the context to the dream helped me better understand why the dream divination was given in the encyclopedia the way that it was. And basically, if you take the character, the written Chinese character for river, and here in this context, it implied the Yellow River, the cradle of Chinese civilization. The Chinese character is made up of different parts. You know, it's not a phonetic alphabet the way that English is. And you can take these pieces of the Chinese character apart, and they reveal other meanings. And that's exactly what the dream diviner had done. He'd taken away the part of the Chinese character that means water in this character for river. If you take it away, you take away the water, you get a different character with the meaning that means you will be okay. You'll be able to be cured. The state will survive. And I just found that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Dreams and health. Did the Chinese see these two things connected, health and dreams?
Yes, absolutely. The dreams could indicate issues in the body. And I think also they sort of revealed for the dreamer sort of potential issues to look out for in an area that I guess today we might think of as morality rather than health. But I think historically in China, these were much more connected, that nightmares and dreams of a certain nature indicated moral failings that could lead to a kind of illness, which I also think is very interesting.
It is indeed. Bridget Vance, our guest today, historian and associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Fun talking with her about the cultural history of dreams. And you can join in, too. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the cultural history of dreams today with our guest Bridget Vance, historian, associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Great to have her with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I would guess that dreams have had influence over religion, too. I know there's mention of dreams as guidance from God in the Bible.
Yes.
What about in early modern China?
Yes, it's also the case that folks then believed many things about dreams, certainly. And one aspect of those beliefs was precisely that you know, they didn't believe in a Christian God, but that these were dreams were gifts in a way. They were messages sent from another realm. We can call it the spirit realm, otherworldly, if you will. And there was also this sort of belief. It's like, how did dreams work? How did we dream? And treatises that included information about different aspects of the soul. So there was an earthly soul and a heavenly soul, and these resided inside of people. And when they dreamed, the sort of the heavenly soul or the heavenly spirit would leave the body and would wander. And dreams were what that heavenly soul or heavenly spirit encountered while wandering. So, there were certainly many aspects, I would say, of spirituality, of religion, of religious practice that were very connected with dreams and with dreaming.
I was thinking about bad dreams because every once in a while, there's a bad dream that I have. It doesn't come up very often, but in fact, I know it's coming, and I try to wake myself up and often wake myself up because I know it's coming.
You know what's coming, yeah.
I know what's coming next. So every once in a while, I'll have a nightmare, and probably most people have in their lives. Historically, what role did nightmares play in China?
Oh, there's some very interesting beliefs about nightmares. So according to some practitioners of Buddhism, nightmares actually indicated these sort of moral failing on the part of the individual, that if your spirit was really calm and connected, you wouldn't have nightmares. So that was one part of it. And then the other part of it was there was a belief in a spirit that resided in people's households and kind of watched over the household. And every so often, that particular spirit would ascend to heaven and report on the moral transgressions of the household members. And there was a practice where people would try to stay up all night long the night that this particular spirit was supposed to leave the house and report on them so that it couldn't leave. So you know, if you didn't sleep, you wouldn't have the nightmare, and if you didn't have the nightmare, you couldn't get reported on.
I was a bad person today. I'm staying up all night.
Exactly. Better safe than sorry.
Oh, man. Colleen from New Holstein emailed us wondering if you know anything about the First Nations Dream Quest.
Oh, you know, I've heard of this. And I think it would be very, very interesting to do a little bit more work on. But it's, you know, this sort of rite of passage and a period of solitude and seeking personal growth through dreams and visions. And I think that, it, you know, although there isn't, I would say, there isn't an identical quest that I know of in early modern China, you can still see, I would say, some of the same impulses in the kinds of questions that people asked of their dreams, and also in these pilgrimages that folks undertook to go visit particular sites that were associated with dreams and dreaming.
Hmm. Let's go to Kenneth in Beloit now. Kenneth, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Larry. I was wondering about comparisons of Western dream interpretation, such as provided by Carl Jung, and compared to her interpretation of the Eastern Chinese interpretations, as their guests done any of that comparisons?
So comparing Eastern and Western dream interpretations.
Yes. You know, a few summers ago, I was able to travel to Zurich, Switzerland, to the C.G. Jung Institute, and I took some courses there. I was very interested in comparative dream work. And I think one of the things that really struck me is, you know, in, I would say, in the Jungian approach to dreams and dream interpretation, there's this sort of sense of the quote unquote big dream, dreams that sort of transcend the individual, and then also the relationship between the sort of personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. And although you don't see that in the early modern Chinese context talked about in the same way. There's certainly this sense that there are symbols that transcend the individual, that have, I would say, a deeper connection culturally, that have meaning for more than one person. So I do see some parallels there. And I think also in terms of the attitude of what gets talked about and the attention to dreams. And I think for Jung, dreams were the path really to understanding. And one way of, I would say, accessing individuation, sort of this growth process in the individual. And I would say for early modern Chinese dreamers too, dreams offered clarity for an understanding of what was going on in their lives, not just as individuals, but also the ways in which they connected to one another. So hopefully that answered your question.
Kenneth, did that answer?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So I'm trying to come up with, and maybe you've answered it in parts, but what methods did the Chinese use to figure out what their dreams meant?
Ah, yes, there are quite a few. There's, you know, one of them that I think is probably one that every culture uses is symbolism. So if you have a dream and it's about, you know, rain or mountains, right? You can kind of figure out what are the associations and what do those symbols mean. So one method of dream interpretation relied heavily on looking at the symbols in the dream. Another I refer to as resonances, and it has to do with, I would say, connections between some aspect of the dream and some aspect of waking life. And these can be historical allusions. These could be names of particular figures. These could be connections with previous dreams, anything of that nature. Another is glyphomancy. And this is something that I talked about earlier in the dream of the emperor who dreamed that the Yellow River dried up. And in that case, the dream diviner used glyphomancy, or the sort of dissection, the pulling apart of elements in Chinese characters. There's also homophonic interpretation. So if you dream of something that has the same pronunciation as something else, that can also sometimes reveal meanings of a dream. So I'd say those are probably the most common dream interpretation techniques that I've seen.
Okay. Jordan in Marengo has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jordan.
Hey there. I have an incredibly deluxe, very vivid, hysterical dream life. Parenthetically, my only reoccurring nightmare is that I'm chewing a piece of gum and I can't get it out of my mouth, and then the gum keeps expanding and expanding. And that's pretty scary in itself. But my main point question is, I'm only a survey sample of one, right? So, but through an amazing, amazing dream life that I look forward to, I just can't point to anything back in my past that's actually portentous in any way. So my question observation is, what do you think, like the percentage or ratio or even a historical meta perspective of what is actually portentous in dreams versus what do we wish it was portentous in dreams? Anyway, thanks. That's my comment, and thanks for the show.
Thanks, Jordan.
Oh, very interesting. Oh, wow. Thanks for sharing. The gum in the mouth dream, that I could, you know, as you were talking, I could feel it in my own mouth. And I just thought, wow, that's it's a vivid description. And I think that would be scary indeed. So it's interesting to think about dreams that foretell the future. You know, I have a friend of mine, his wife, about three times in her life has had a dream that told the future. And I don't want to put words into someone else's mouth, but, you know, in talking with her about it, she found that responsibility very scary. And I think that there's a fascination and a hope, just as you said, about what we'd sort of would love to know. I mean, goodness, if I had the ability to tell the future, I'd know exactly when to buy the lottery tickets. It'd be great. But I think a lot of the time, my guess is that it really is much more about offering, dreams are, you know, much more about offering us the chance to reflect on things that are sort of happening more or less in the moment, and processing. And certainly, you know, the recent findings from neuroscientists on the relationship between dreams and emotional regulation and memory consolidation. Those are some of the functions that we think of now. But I do think that there are these moments, these glimpses. I don't think I myself have had any pretentious dreams. but they're, you hear about them and you read about them, and that's, those are the ones that get recorded and that sort of call to us, that speak to us, because they're fascinating. And exactly as you said, we sort of wish for it, don't we?
Yes. Tab in Mesa Mani, let's go there. Hi, Tab.
Good morning. My question is, does what you eat and when you eat supper, does that have any effect on your dreams?
There's probably yes and no. I've heard so many, many people speak about the relationship between what you eat, when you eat, and what you dream. You know, just last week I was at a wedding and got up the next morning and had very strange dreams. And, you know, my brother-in-law said, oh, it's because we ate all that fried food at the wedding. You know, and I think, too, of Ebenezer Scrooge and A Christmas Carol, sort of suspecting that the Marley visit is because of what he ate. You know, there's more of gravy than of grave about you. So we see these references in literature and culturally, absolutely. And again, even in this early modern Chinese context, one of the sections of this Dream Encyclopedia lists all the relationship between the time that you have the dream and what the dream means. So I think there was this assumption that absolutely that the timing of what you eat and when you sleep does shift and impact your dream.
I was thinking about that. I just visited a daughter in Kansas for a week, and as usual, when I go someplace and sleep in a new bed, I always have dreams. And some vivid ones. And maybe it's the excitement of a trip or just being in a different bed that causes my brain to get going.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime we move around, you know, we're a little unsettled, and things can absolutely happen when we change the context in which we're living and sleeping and therefore dreaming.
Dennis emailed us, when a caller asked about Carl Jung, Dennis thought about this. The concept of the shadow self is rooted in Jungian psychology, where the shadow represents the unconscious and the repressed aspects of the personality, and wonders, are nightmares from our shadow selves?
Yeah, I think that certainly some people would say yes, that it's the, you know, if we look at Jungian psychology, I think that the one interpretation would indeed be that it's, you know, psyche is trying to tell us something and bring something that maybe we're not that keen on, that that we don't know about. It doesn't necessarily need to be bad. It's just unknown or as yet unknown, and bringing it into the fore so that we can get to know that part of ourselves, that unknown.
How much value do we in the U.S. the culture place on dreams today, do you think?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I suppose some level there's, I certainly see people who sort of poo-poo them and say, well, I don't remember my dreams and, you know, they don't matter. And then almost inevitably you start to talk to people a little bit more, and people have very interesting dreams, and we're curious. The human beings, we're naturally curious. And so it kind of makes sense to me that we do wonder, and we say, well, what's to it? We spend so much of our lives sleeping and so much of our sleeping lives dreaming, that is there meaning to it? And this is, again, where I think it really does depend on the individual. If you don't think it has any meaning, then it may not. But if you start to look at your dreams, they do begin to change. and respond. And I think it can be a very interesting process to think about them, to reflect on them.
And pay attention to them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It may say something about maybe the time we're living in. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, Bridget, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I'm always fascinated by talking about dreams, and it's interesting to hear about your research in particular. Thank you very much, and I hope we can do this again.
Oh, yeah, it was really a pleasure, and the questions were so interesting for me. So thanks to everyone who called or wrote in.
Bridget Vance is our guest, a historian and associate professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Well, did you ever have a dream about beer? I can't remember if I've ever had one about beer, but maybe I'll have one tonight because we're talking about beer next and beer making with our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.